This is episode 237 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. I'm the Solomonster. It is Night of Champions Sunday, September 16th, 2012. Certainly been a newsworthy week for all the wrong reasons, although there is good news to report now. So all's well that ends well. Of course, I'm talking about the Jerry Lawler situation. I'll have a lot to say about that in just a second. But first, there is a pay-per-view tonight, WWE Night of Champions in John Cena's backyard up in Massachusetts, Boston to be specific. And as I mentioned on Twitter, we are going to be doing a special one-hour edition of SE Scoops Live before the pay-per-view tonight. So 1 hour before the pay-per-view itself, not the pre-show. 7 o'clock Eastern on SEScoops.com. You can log on to the main page. The information will be there as far as streaming the show. Calling in, we'll be taking phone calls as well, so the phone number will be up. Myself and Noah Mark talking Night of Champions, and I will be saving my pay-per-view predictions for the live show. So I'll do a quick run-through here of the pay-per-view matches. But if you want my predictions, for whatever that's worth, you can tune into the live show tonight on SEScoops.com at 7 o'clock Eastern. I'll have my predictions there. So join us. Should be a good time. Also, Jim Ross is in Boston. And it's notable because he tweeted yesterday. He's been getting a lot of tweets about, you know, will Jerry Lawler be back for the pay-per-view, which, of course, is complete nonsense since he's still up in Montreal in the hospital. But getting all these different tweets, and he responded to somebody by saying, Cole will not be flying solo on tonight's show. Just watch and see. Which made me think that good old JR himself may be filling in for the King on commentary with Michael Cole, and the fact that he is in Boston, Massachusetts, would lead one to believe we may be seeing JR on the show tonight. I guess we'll find out. Also, there was an article on the, I believe, the Boston Herald website talking about John Cena, who will be debuting a new outfit tonight on the pay-per-view. He'll be wearing a pink hat and a Rise Above Cancer t-shirt with pink colors. I think it's pink and black. And he'll be wearing it for the next month as part of National Breast Cancer Awareness Month here in the U.S. A noble cause. And it's notable that once the article went up this morning, it didn't take very long, for example, on SE Scoops and other websites as well. SE Scoops is certainly not immune to this. But I was looking through some of the comments under the news item on SE Scoops and the SE Scoops Facebook page. And, you know, to the people ragging on John Cena for doing this, just get a life. You know, the dude's brother was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor last year. He wants to do something good to raise awareness for cancer. In this case, it's breast cancer. You know, and yet there are still people raking him over the coals for pandering for, you know, pandering to charities and PG, and, you know, it's all just a ploy to make WWE look good, and they're criticizing him for wearing pink. I guess these people must be colorblind, because I didn't hear them complaining that the WWE champion, CM Punk, was wearing pink only this past Monday night, in fact. See, that's one small way for Cena to help a worthy cause. It's no different than Major League Baseball having its players use pink bats every season to raise awareness for the same thing. I'm actually doing a run myself next weekend to help raise some money for leukemia research. What are these people doing, other than raising awareness for brain damage research? Now, for all the talk this week about how, thank God, Jerry Lawler managed to avoid any brain damage after his heart attack, you need not look any further than the comment sections on certain wrestling websites to see just how big a problem brain damage really is in this country. It just makes me sick. So I, for one, commend John Cena for doing it. I think it's a really cool thing, and we'll see that on the pay-per-view tonight. I guess he will be debuting his new attire. He, of course, is challenging CM Punk in the main event for the WWE Championship. World Championship on the line. Sheamus defending yet again I've lost count what number match this is between the two of them, but he'll be defending against Alberto Del Rio. Layla defends her Divas Championship against Caitlin. Randy Orton will have a match with Dolph Ziggler, which promises to be, at worst, good, and at best, potentially a show stealer. Kofi Kingston and R-Truth defend the tag team titles against Kane and Daniel Bryan, new BFFs. The Miz defends the Intercontinental Championship in a four-way against Sin Cara, Rey Mysterio, and Cody Rhodes. And Antonio Cesaro will defend his United States Championship against the winner of a pre-show Battle Royal. There is a Battle Royal taking place at 7:30 on the YouTube pre-show, which will be taking place during the second half of SE Scoops Live tonight, which should be interesting. And so he will defend his title against the winner of that Battle Royal. So that's the card as of right now for Night of Champions. Again, I'll have my predictions on these matches with Noah Mark. We'll talk about that a little bit later on tonight. That brings us to, as I mentioned before, what was a very newsworthy week, stemming from what took place in Montreal this past Monday night on Raw. This was supposed to be a landmark evening, because this was the first time in 15 years since the infamous Montreal Screwjob that Bret the Hitman Hart was making his return to a WWE ring in Montreal. I'm sure he's been back to Montreal numerous times for appearances and such. But the first time we're seeing him at an event like this since Survivor Series, and the match with Shawn Michaels that led to a lot of different things. That obviously led to Bret's departure, although he was already on his way out to WCW. It led to really the Attitude Era. I mean, there were a lot of things in 97 that kind of built to the Attitude Era, but it led to one of the most, if not the most prosperous period in the history of WWE. And so that was a big deal. So Bret came out on this show, and he got a hero's welcome, and it was really cool to see. And a hot crowd, too, in Montreal. But all of that irrelevant, given what would take place about midway through. As everybody is well aware by now, Jerry the King Lawler suffered a massive heart attack this past Monday night, live on the air, during an episode of Raw. He had competed only a little bit earlier in a tag team match. In fact, he was actually one of the candidates in one of these Raw active polls. People could vote on whether or not they wanted to see CM Punk wrestle Jerry Lawler again, or wrestle, I believe the other choices were Brodus Clay and Randy Orton. And Randy Orton got the nod, so there was a match on this show between Punk and Orton, which broke down, and it was turned into a tag team match with Randy Orton teaming with Jerry Lawler against Dolph Ziggler and CM Punk. And Lawler looked fine in the match. He wrestled. He wasn't in there for the entire time. It was a tag team match. He took some bumps. You go back and watch it, he did kind of, you know, land on the back of his head. He would clutch the back of his head, which looking back, it makes you wonder. But obviously, hindsight being what it is, it wasn't anything in this match that really appeared to lead to what we would see later on. And Lawler looked fine. He came out of the match, went back to the announce booth. And it was during a tag team match a little bit later on. It was the primetime players against Kane and Daniel Bryan when things went south. And I was watching the show, and I started hearing the weird noises just like a lot of you did. And at one point, I thought that perhaps the King was snoring. It sounded very weird to me. It sounded like he was snoring. And, of course, he wasn't snoring. In fact, he was suffering a heart attack. You could see a brief glimpse of him kind of doubled over by the announce desk. The camera did pick up on that. But it was a situation where nobody really knew what was going on. The fans in the crowd were clearly preoccupied. They were watching the announce desk. I thought perhaps that there was a fight, that perhaps somebody had attacked Jerry Lawler in the crowd. They started chanting Jerry. It was unclear what was going on, but it was very much apparent that something bad had just happened, because the commentary went silent for a little bit. Michael Cole sounded very distracted. And they got Lawler out of there very quickly. Within 60 seconds, he was rushed backstage, and all the details, of course, end up coming out that he had actually, for all intents and purposes, died for a little while. He was clinically dead for several minutes. How many minutes, we don't know. How many minutes he went without oxygen? At first, people were speculating he had gone 20 minutes without oxygen to the brain, which obviously was not the case, because if that were the case, he would, in fact, be brain dead right now. But he received CPR right away. That was the first update that Michael Cole came back and let everybody know that Lawler was receiving CPR in the back. And as I understand it, if you're receiving CPR, properly, you are in fact getting some oxygen to the brain. So that would be my guess as to why Jerry Lawler is not a lot worse off right now than he is. And he had to have seven times he was shocked with defibrillators to get his heart beating again. His heart had stopped beating. It was just a very, very serious situation. They cleared out part of the backstage area so they could work on him and transported him to a hospital. Apparently, there's a couple of different hospitals close by to the arena. One that was maybe a minute away. They got him there right away. One of the best, by the way, cardiac units supposedly in the entire world is in this particular hospital up in Montreal. So Lawler got first-class care all the way. And there was a lot of concern, obviously. I mean, it's not a minor thing to suffer a heart attack. There are minor heart attacks that one can suffer. This was obviously not. This was a very serious episode that Lawler had experienced here. And nobody really knew what was going to be the situation at first. You know, everybody was very concerned. Michael Cole was very concerned. The crowd was very concerned. The show took on a totally different tone at that point. I know I personally could not get into anything else on the show. Michael Cole would give sporadic updates at first. I mean, the guy looked white as a sheet. I mean, he looked like a ghost. He looked like he would rather be anywhere but where he was, did Michael Cole. By the end of the show, things were looking up and a little bit more positive, but it was a couple of days before Lawler was even speaking. You know, at that point, it became an issue of, is there any long-term damage to the King? And thankfully, it was on Wednesday morning, I believe it was, when the CT scan on his brain came back, showing that, in fact, there was no brain damage. Lawler was communicating via notepad. He was writing out notes. He knew where he was. And he started speaking again. He had tubes running down his throat. It's kind of hard to speak when you have tubes running down your throat. And, of course, it was a couple of days later, pictures started surfacing of the King in his hospital room. He sent a tout out to all the WWE fans. I've never in my life seen a greater tout than the one that Jerry Lawler posted during the week. Never have I looked more forward to seeing a tout, and probably never again, to be perfectly honest with you. But he was cracking jokes about how he had more wires coming out of him than AT&T. He sounded and looked like the King of old, just with a bunch of wires and tubes. And just very, very, very happy to see the sort of recovery that he's making. And he's not out of the woods yet. Obviously, he's going to have a while to recover coming out of this. And they had to, basically what they had to do, I believe they did an angioplasty on him, which is a heart procedure, and they inserted a stent and blew it up. It's like a balloon. It opens any clogged arteries. He had an artery that was clogged. Apparently, that was the issue. Perhaps, you know, for how long, nobody knows. He is subject to wellness testing in WWE, although I guess it's possible they didn't detect it, but supposedly the wellness testing is done when it comes to the heart, like maybe once a year, so who knows? I mean, maybe it was shortly after the last time he was examined that these problems developed. I mean, there was some question about whether or not perhaps genetics played a role. You know, Lawler apparently in his book, which I have not read, talked about how his father passed away when he, the King, was very young. When Lawler was only in high school, his father died from a heart attack. So perhaps there is some sort of, family history that's involved here, that is at play here. I don't know what his diet consisted of. Apparently he, you know, it's not like he's a vegetarian or anything like that, or eats all that healthy, so perhaps that played a role in it as well. All things considered, for a guy who's 62 years old, the King keeps himself in pretty good shape. And this caught a lot of people off guard. It was a very, very, very scary situation. I personally, it took me back to Owen Hart in 1999 when Michael Cole came back on camera for that first update. I saw, you know, looking at Cole, the way he was stammering over his words, he couldn't get the words out. I thought for sure he was about to tell us that Jerry Lawler had died. And thankfully, that was not the case. But, you know, Cole and King are very good friends. They've been broadcast partners now for, you know, even longer than their time on Raw, because remember, for quite a while there, many, many years ago, Cole and King were announced partners on SmackDown, back when Jerry Lawler used to do commentary on SmackDown in the early days. So, you know, these guys have had a relationship for a number of years. They're very good friends, in spite of what you may see on camera. And it's, you know, it's obviously, it's going to affect you, being that you're sitting right next to the guy when he keels over and collapses on the floor. That's going to fuck with anybody's head. And it's worth it, I think, to mention that Michael Cole, all things considered, did a hell of a job on Monday night. He deserves a ton of credit for keeping things together as best as he could until the end of the show. That could not have been an easy thing for him to do, for him to have to stay out there like that. I'm sure that wasn't his choice. It was, you know, Vince and whoever else in the back telling him exactly what to do, stay out there. Cole did come back on to say that they were going to suspend commentary for the remainder of the show, which was about half an hour or so, which I thought was a good move on their part. He would check in with sporadic updates, but there were pictures that people were sending in of poor Michael Cole sitting at ringside, completely not paying any attention to the matches that were still happening on the ring, head in his hands. You know, the guy just looked, it was one of the saddest photos I've ever seen. And I think he just, he deserves a lot of credit. He deserves a lot of credit not only for keeping things together, but by all accounts, Michael Cole, maybe, you know, the EMTs and the doctors in the back saved Lawler's life. There's no doubt that had they not acted as quickly as they did and jumped into action, that the guy would be dead right now. You know, we would be talking about the life and times of Jerry the King Lawler. So those guys, they did their job. They did their job well. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. And I'm sure Lawler, if he hasn't already, will be looking to thank those guys that saved his life. But, you know, listening to the details about how everything went down, Michael Cole did an interview on, he did multiple interviews, actually. He was interviewed on Fox and Friends on the Fox News Channel. He was interviewed by WWE.com, gave some more details about what happened. Cole deserves credit also, I think, for helping save Lawler's life. He saw what was going on. You know, he muted the audio so that, you know, we didn't have to hear what was going on. And immediately started yelling for the ringside doctor and got their attention. They came over. Apparently they came over and they weren't exactly jumping to action right away. Once they saw Lawler, he was turning bluish. He was clearly in distress. That's when they started panicking. They jumped into action. They got him into to the back as quickly as they could. Those seconds, those first few minutes were so precious. Probably not only in saving Lawler's life, but preventing any sort of long-term brain damage or anything like that. Cole deserves credit for that. You know, he really does. And he gets ragged on a lot, and rightfully so. It's the way that his character is booked on TV. I think in a lot of ways, Vince McMahon probably lives vicariously through the Michael Cole character. We see it every week. I mean, the Cole character has been so bipolar over the last couple of months in that, you know, one week it looks like he's completely dropped his shtick as being this heel kind of antagonizer on commentary or heel sympathizer, and then the next week he'll be right back at it, and it's really at the whims of Vince McMahon. To me, WWE needs to do the right thing here and drop Cole's shtick at this point and just let him be an announcer, because as we saw on Monday night, you know, when you allow him to do that, he's pretty good, you know? He is. I mean, when he's the straight man, he's not the best wrestling announcer you'll ever hear, but he's good. When he's allowed to be. And if there's any other good things that could possibly come from a situation like this, I think it's going to be awfully hard for people to boo Michael Cole. It'll be very interesting to see what kind of reaction, for example, when he comes out at the pay-per-view tonight or on Raw this Monday night, you know, from the live audience or even, you know, while we're watching it on TV from the people in the crowd. Just do the right thing. Let Cole be what he is, which is the play-by-play announcer, who, you know, tells us about what's going on in the ring, promotes the pay-per-view matches, and let the color person give further insight. That's the way it should be. You know, there's a reason that, again, back in the day, Vince McMahon, Gorilla Monsoon, Jim Ross, people who were in the play-by-play role were not, you know, playing some heel character where they were, you know, it's just a complete role reversal, I think, from what we're used to seeing from wrestling announcers. That's what Cole's been doing for about 2 years now. And I think if there's one other outcome that possibly comes from this, let this be the end of that Michael Cole character. It was fine for a while, you know, when he first started doing that stuff on NXT, and then we started seeing him do it on Raw. Lawler got his first and only WrestleMania match as a result of that feud. I know Lawler for years talked about wanting to wrestle at WrestleMania, and you know, with his career now somewhat in a state of uncertainty, it's actually really nice to know that he finally got that WrestleMania match last year. It may not have been a great match, and I know when it was over, they reversed the outcome, and it'll go down as a loss for Jerry Lawler. But that was a big deal to the King to get that WrestleMania match with Michael Cole last year, and that's really cool that he was able to get that. But you know what? Cole earned a lot of respect, I think, from people this week. He should be allowed to maintain that respect going forward and not start goofing off again tonight or in a couple of weeks. So I just wanted to say that for all the shit that Michael Cole gets from me included, you know, when he's good, you know, when he does something good or he's on his game, he deserves a lot of praise, and none more so, I think, than this week. So I think that's worth mentioning. It was kind of odd having the last 30, 40 minutes of the show without commentary. For anybody who's never been to a WWE event before, whether it's a house show or a TV taping, you kind of got a taste of what it's like. Just getting all of the sounds from the environment, the crowd reaction, or lack thereof. I mean, when Tyson Kidd came out for that match with, I think it was with Del Rio, you could hear a pin drop. And they were in Canada. You would think that Tyson Kidd, with his ties to the Hart family and background up in Canada, would get a nice big reaction. And I'm sure had this not happened, he would have. But the crowd was completely dead. People were concerned. People knew what was going on. Unlike the situation, I think, to some degree, with Owen back in 99, where some people saw that happen in person. I mean, on TV, they didn't show it. But there were people in the building who saw Owen fall, and they were very concerned. But they never gave the live crowd any sort of update, nor did they on this show either, by the way. The only thing they did was they had Justin Roberts later on announce to the crowd that their Pat Patterson Appreciation Night stuff that was planned after the show was being postponed. They never gave an update to the live audience. The live audience never heard Michael Cole giving an update on the King's condition. And you can argue either way whether or not that's right or wrong. But obviously, the people just weren't into the show. And at that point, even recapping Raw here, it's a little bit fuzzy. I mean, I remember you know, a lot of the stuff leading up to it, what happened after that. I think Sheamus had a match with David Otunga. I mean, who cares? Who could possibly care at that point? But, you know, as far as back to Lawler for a second here, just to get back to that, if I can, it's interesting, you know, his son, Brian Lawler, who went up there to be with his dad, was doing a radio interview the other day and actually said that when Lawler kind of came to and was communicating with them, he thought he was in a hospital in Aruba. Because over the weekend, Jerry Lawler had actually appeared at an independent show in Aruba. I don't think he wrestled. He appeared during a Piper's Pit segment. But Lawler may not have any recollection at all about Raw from Monday night. Apparently, he doesn't remember what happened, but I'm not sure he even remembers being at Raw in Montreal. He may not remember any of that. And probably for the better that he actually has as little recollection of that night as possible. But I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, there has to be concerns also about his memory, if there's any sort of significant memory loss. And it seems like the memory loss may only be limited to Monday, which is, again, probably a good thing. But, you know, he woke up, he wasn't exactly sure of where he was, and it was very emotional. But, again, very, very happy to see the King doing better. And, you know, there's a lot of questions now that this situation raises. So, for example, you know, is this the end of Jerry Lawler's in-ring career? Jerry Lawler is 62 years old. He's not a young man, even though he may look relatively young for a guy his age. He looks pretty good. But is it time to hang up the boots and call it quits? Ultimately, that's a decision that Lawler is going to have to make. There were reports indicating that his doctors had told him that once he makes a full recovery, he would be able to return to the ring. And, you know, the way I look at it is, if the doctors think that he's healthy enough to make a return to the ring and Lawler wants to wrestle, I can't see Lawler not wanting to get back into the ring, then I say let him wrestle. Because, you know, if the doctors say it's fine and the guy wants to wrestle, then who is anybody to say that you can't? If he wants to wrestle independently, that's fine. Let him wrestle. I have no problem with that. I don't know that WWE would want him to wrestle. And that's going to be the interesting question going forward. We have seen Lawler used an awful lot over the last year and a half or so, going back to the Michael Cole stuff. I mean, Lawler, I think, he wrestled on the first four pay-per-views of 2011. I mean, he you know, or at least there were four or five total pay-per-views, I think, maybe last year that he competed in. So he got some nice paydays, I'm sure, including WrestleMania. I don't know that Lawler, since the days when he was a more active wrestler, probably in the 90s, has been used in an in-ring role more often than he has been in 2011 and 2012. WWE is in an interesting position here because, you know, times are different now than they used to be. They're under a lot more scrutiny. There wasn't TMZ and stuff like that back in the day. They're a public company. They've got the Linda McMahon stuff. They're very gun-shy about certain things. This was a highly publicized event. I mean, the Associated Press picked up on it, and I mean, it was broadcast all over the world. The news of Lawler's heart attack was picked up everywhere. I mean, everybody knows that Lawler had a heart attack. And if you're WWE, do you allow a 62-year-old man who, on the outside looking in, there's probably a lot of people saying, well, why the hell did they let him wrestle? There's a lot of people who probably realize or read the reports that he wrestled a match 20 or 30 minutes earlier, and they figure, well, that's why he had the heart attack, even if that had absolutely nothing to do with it. But it's just an interesting position, I think, for the company to be in. Do you allow him to wrestle again, or do you just say, listen, you know, for the same reasons they probably don't want Ric Flair back in the ring if they ever bring him back, you reach a certain point, you reach a certain age, something like this happens on their show. This happened on their show, and thank God it did, because, you know, if he would have had that heart attack driving to the hotel, if he would have had that heart attack in Aruba at that independent show, you know, who knows if Lawler would still be here. There's a pretty good chance he wouldn't be here right now. You know, we'd be reading his epitaph or something. I mean, it's definitely possible. So thank God if it was going to happen, it happened when and where it did. But this happened live on the air on their television show. And it wouldn't surprise me if WWE just did not want him back in the ring. You know, I mean, who even knows if their doctors would clear him? I guess time will tell. But again, I say if he wants to wrestle, let him wrestle. I'm not sure WWE would want him wrestling on their show. So that'll just be an interesting question going forward. I mean, it's not really important right now. But as far as him wrestling, I personally don't believe we've seen the last Jerry Lawler match. In WWE, maybe. Maybe. I mean, it's certainly possible. And you know, the other question that it raises also is people asking, well, you know, was it right for them to keep the show going? It was the same thing with the Owen Hart thing in 99. Is WWE right for continuing the show, or should they have stopped the show? I will say that there was a point, probably around 10:30 or so, I tweeted that I just felt like they should just stop the show. But that was more because I just couldn't get into it. How could anybody who knew what was going on, and most people in that building seemed to know what was going on, even though they weren't getting updates, how do you get into a show like that at that point? You know, and it's one thing to have matches. They had, you know, Rey Mysterio had a match, I think, with Cody, and they had the Sheamus Otunga match. Del Rio, I think, and Tyson Kidd. You know, that's one thing. But they were still airing comedy segments with Kane and Daniel Bryan. Who the hell cares about comedy with Kane and Daniel Bryan at that point? And I think in the Kane skit, I mean, talk about bad timing. He was talking about burnt corpses or something like that. I mean, that's just an unfortunate choice of words. I mean, they didn't know. But stuff like that, I just felt at that moment, just stop the show. I mean, they're, you know, I personally just couldn't get into it. But you know what? That I'm not criticizing WWE for continuing the show. There is no right or wrong. You know, it's a situation that nobody expected. You don't know how to react. Everyone's panicking. Everybody's freaking out. Lawler is still backstage being worked on. The guy is not dead. I mean, maybe he was technically dead for a little while, but you know, he's still very much alive. They're still, you know, working on him and trying to assist him. I'm not going to criticize one way or the other. I'm not going to say it was right or wrong. They did what they felt they had to do. I thought it was a good move on their part to suspend commentary and have Cole acknowledge it and give updates. Because at first, they didn't even have Cole acknowledge it. And I was a little worried about that, because how the hell do you not acknowledge that Jerry Lawler, who was just sitting next to Michael Cole, just had a heart attack and is no longer there? You know, where did he go? So thankfully, they at least they did give updates. But I'm not going to take a position on this one way or the other. I can't criticize WWE. I have, you know, come around all these years later, and I've talked about this on the Sound Off before. I do believe that with what happened with Owen Hart back in 99, looking back, they made the wrong decision on that. I do believe they should have stopped the show when Owen died. I mean, but that's a completely different situation. I mean, Owen Hart, you know, fell from the ceiling 80 feet down. He died in the ring. By all accounts, he did. He died in the ring. It wasn't a situation where they brought him in the back, and you know, I'm sure they were still, you know, trying to save his life at that point. By all accounts, Owen Hart actually died in the ring, and they announced on the air once they knew for sure that he had in fact died, and they kept the show going at that point. Looking back on that, I believe that was the wrong move to make. That was a completely different situation, though, in some ways. Because, again, you're dealing with a person who actually died. Thankfully, in this case, that didn't happen. But, again, I can't criticize them too much. I think it probably would make sense, though, to put some sort of... to have some rules of some kind put in place to address this sort of stuff in the future. I mean, thankfully, it doesn't happen very often. I hope something like this never, ever happens again. But the first thing you hear is nobody knew what to do. Right? That's what people were saying, that people in the back were panicking. They didn't know what to do. There was some talk about maybe ending the show, and they decided not to. Other people say there was never any talk about ending the show. There were a lot of conflicting reports coming from various wrestling websites as this was going on. Might make sense to have some sort of policy in place. I mean, look, they have a policy for blood, right? What's the first thing you see when somebody bleeds hard way to any significant degree in the ring? I'm not talking about a little tiny cut. Whenever somebody gets busted open, what's the first thing that you see? The referee pulls out a pair of latex gloves. Every referee has latex gloves now in their pocket. And the first thing they do is they take them out, they put them on. Then normally you'll see a doctor, a ringside doctor, slide into the ring with a towel and they'll take care of the cut. They'll super glue it shut or whatever the case may be. Obviously, they have a policy in place for that. This is a company that's very regimented now. They have policies and rules for everything. There's a lot more rules now than there were 10, 12 years ago. Might be worth it to have some rules put in place for something like this. If, God forbid, there's some other sort of disaster, somebody gets paralyzed, somebody has a heart attack or a stroke, somebody dies, if there's a fan who brings a weapon into the ring or something like that, there probably should be some sort of some rule or policy in place for this going forward. So that way, in the future, you can't say nobody knew what to do because there are rules, and there are rules to follow, and you know, WWE no longer has the excuse, well, you know, we didn't know what to do. So anyway, that's the situation on Jerry Lawler. As far as I know, he is still up in the hospital in Montreal. Jim Ross has said that he's likely to go home later this week, back home to Memphis, and that means obviously no Lawler tonight, no Lawler this week on TV, probably not next week either. I don't know when Jerry Lawler will be back on commentary. Probably there'll be a time and a place to talk about who should replace him if he's going to be out for any length of time. I think it's just way too premature to even talk about that. They certainly have options. You know, if Jim Ross is on the pay-per-view tonight, they could certainly have JR fill in for him for a couple of weeks. I'm sure Jim Ross wouldn't mind doing that. They can go with Josh Matthews. They can, you know, they got Paul Heyman now under contract. If they wanted to use Paul Heyman, he certainly has a big mouth. They could put that to good use. My hope is that they won't even really have to think too hard about this. It'll be a 1 or 2 week temporary situation, and hopefully Lawler is well enough to come back in a couple of weeks. That would certainly be a great sign. Let him take as much time as he needs, even if that's a few months, quite frankly. I don't care. I mean, hopefully the guy will take as long as he needs to recover from this. But again, if they need options, they have options. And one other thing I just wanted to mention here is, you know, there were some people I noticed online on YouTube or whatever. I did that commentary on the Sound Off only a couple of weeks ago. So again, unfortunate timing. Nobody could have predicted something like this would happen. But I did do that commentary where I talked about the fact that I think the time had come for Jerry Lawler to probably leave the announce booth on Raw, because the Jerry Lawler that we see on TV every week now doing commentary is not the Jerry Lawler that was so entertaining in that role so many years ago. You know, that the way things are now in WWE, it's not all his fault. Things are a lot different now than they used to be, and it's PG and all that stuff. And so, you know, he's just not what he used to be. And so I argue that perhaps, you know, and I gave different options about who maybe could replace him. And if you wanted to keep Lawler, you can do some sort of split team deal where you have, you know, maybe Jim Ross and William Regal take an hour and then have Cole and King do the rest of the show. That might take some of the stress and pressure off them. And quite frankly, I like that option the most. But I just wanted to bring that up because there were people online saying, oh, are you happy now? You got what you wanted. No, you fool. Nobody was saying that Jerry Lawler should have a heart attack and or die and therefore leave the announce booth. I was merely arguing, and I would still argue. My opinion hasn't changed. I'm not going to apologize for what I said. I felt a certain way. And I led that little commentary off, by the way. Some people might want to ignore it because, you know, they have their own agenda. But I did say that I like Jerry Lawler. I like Jerry Lawler a lot. Jerry Lawler is fantastic when they use him for an angle like they have in the past, whether it's with Miz, Punk, or whatever the case may be. He's an old-school guy. He's very, very good. It's just that on commentary, he's not what he used to be, and they do have other options if they wanted to freshen things up a little bit. I still firmly believe that, but having said that, I for one cannot wait to have Jerry Lawler back on commentary. I think, you know, when he is ready and able to come back to the announce booth, and I'm sure he will, it's going to be a fantastic moment, and I hope he gets, you know, a great reaction, and quite frankly, to see him when the time is right come walking out on Raw back to the announce booth. and maybe even sharing an embrace with Michael Cole, for crying out loud, and they could put their they could put their issues behind them from a storyline perspective. To me, that's just the best moment in Raw history waiting to happen right there, and I hope it happens real soon. And can't wait to hear Jerry Lawler back at the booth, because it was a very scary situation. For all intents and purposes, this guy should not be walking around right now, and he is, and I think that's pretty amazing, and just really cool to see. As far as the rest of the show is concerned, again, I took some quick notes. I don't remember everything that happened. I did see the segment with Sheamus and Otunga that they had recorded earlier that day, the comedy stuff with the lawyers and everything. And, you know, I will say that Sheamus's Jewish joke about his last name, Lipschitz, he says, "If my Lipschitz, then what does my arse do?" I did laugh at that. I did actually find that very funny. And boy, I didn't know that Sheamus has some Jewish blood in him. Hopefully he'll have a happy new year. This is the Jewish New Year coming up this week. By the way, that goes out to all of our Jewish listeners as well, if you do celebrate, Happy New Year. So I thought that was actually kind of funny. I thought the segment went a little too long. I thought it was kind of dumb, you know, bro kicking the camera and whatever, but whatever. I mean, that part of the segment made me laugh. The Divas match on the show, just for those who are interested, I did do the Divas stopwatch again. Less than 2.5 minutes. So again, on a 3-hour show, the Divas aren't really getting a whole hell of a lot of time to do much of anything. Unfortunately. The other thing also is I was flipping channels during the commercials, and I think it was probably during the tag match with Lawler, ironically enough. And I flipped Raw back on, and I saw Vicky Guerrero standing at ringside, and I legit wondered to myself, why is she holding a lunchbox? That was my first thought. She was holding the Money in the Bank briefcase that Dolph has, but my first thought was, why is Vicky holding a lunchbox at ringside? And anyway, so I tweeted about that. I said, you know what? That's actually not a bad idea. WWE should start marketing Money in the Bank lunchboxes. Quite frankly, I'm shocked they haven't already done this. Maybe they are. I mean, if there are Money in the Bank lunchboxes out there that they're selling, let me know. But I don't think they are, and I think that's a hell of an idea right there. You can have a red lunchbox, right, for the Raw Money in the Bank. You could have a blue lunchbox with the Money in the Bank sticker on it for SmackDown, and you can sell them for $10 a pop or $12 a pop. They'll probably make some decent money off it. And I got a text message during the show from Noah Mark telling me that WWE had retweeted my idea, and I had not noticed that, and I was actually wondering why I picked up so many new followers in such a short period of time. And Twitter actually made it one of its top tweets, which was kind of cool. So we may end up getting some Money in the Bank lunchboxes before we get those ice cream bars. I guess we'll find out. The only other thing on Raw that I really want to just mention here is that final segment. I was not in the mood, given what was going on, to listen to a John Cena promo at the end of the show. I just wasn't into it. But worth noting, John Cena was fantastic, I thought, in that final segment. Probably the best promo he's done all year. It was him, CM Punk, and Bret Hart. It was Bret Hart was supposed to be interviewing John Cena. CM Punk came out, then it became a back and forth between Punk and Cena. And very little comedy, obviously. I mean, really, you don't want to be telling jokes the whole time, given what was going on. But I just thought Cena was to the point. He was fiery. He was intense. He made some valid points. He dropped some language we don't normally hear him dropping in these promos. He called Punk a son of a bitch. He said he was going to kick his ass. He turned that Montreal crowd that was booing the hell out of him when he came out, he turned that Montreal crowd in his favor, which is not an easy thing for him to do. And I know he was talking in French, you know, which is no different than heels coming out and trying to get cheap heat by bashing whatever city sports teams there are and stuff like that. But the crowd loved it, and it wasn't just the French talking, I think. I mean, he did a fantastic job in just turning that crowd in his favor and selling a match that, quite frankly, and I don't know that the message was really received, because, again, everybody's thoughts were on the Jerry Lawler situation. I don't know how many extra pay-per-views Cena sold just with this promo. I think under normal circumstances, it was what you would call a money promo. It was great. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It got you wanting to see John Cena versus CM Punk if it wasn't a match you didn't already want to see. And like I said, it was some of the best work Cena's done all year. So if I had one criticism of it, and again, it's a minor one, but if I did have one criticism of it, I didn't like the political overtones of seeing his speech. You know, he made some very good points about Punk not following through on the changes that he promised last year. You know, a new title belt and all these other, the ice cream bars and everything else. Very valid points. But it was so obviously scripted to please Vince McMahon, who hates the president. You know, Obama's whole thing about change and all that. And whatever your political leanings are, it doesn't matter. It has no place on a wrestling show. Nothing good can come from bringing politics into the mix. You know, politics and religion are the two things. They don't mix well, and they don't mix well in other things. So just leave it out. It really didn't have any place here. So again, minor criticism. I could have done without that. You know, much like with Cole, who more often than not is very annoying and very grating on the nerves and deserves to be bashed and ridiculed. Much as with Cole on this show, who deserves praise, I think, for his role, Cena deserves credit as well. Cena did a hell of a job here. Cena looked like he was also a little bit out of it when he came out. You know, he wasn't as jolly and energetic as he normally is, and I would imagine he wouldn't be. I mean, it must have been a madhouse in the back, given what was going on. Punk came out, he looked like he always looked. You know, he didn't look like anything was wrong at all, and Bret Hart was Bret Hart. You know, he was fine. But Cena, I thought, did just an excellent job in this final segment. So if you were going to do the final segment, they did about as good a job with it as they could. And we got the best news that we could get at the very end, because Cole came on for that one last update about Lawler. He looked completely different than he did in that first update. Like I said, when he came on screen for that first update, he looked like he just was white as a sheet. And for that last update, he sounded more like Michael Cole, and he was very up. They had some upbeat news about Jerry Lawler. And so all things considered, that was a nice way for the show to end. But Raw 1007 will go down in the history books as one of the more infamous episodes of Raw for all the wrong reasons. And, yeah, all the best to Jerry Lawler. Hopefully he'll be back on TV soon enough once he's good and ready to come back. All's well that ends well. This could have been a really, really sad ending, and I'm very very happy to see that that was not the case. Let's talk about Impact Wrestling here. I did not see the entire No Surrender pay-per-view from last weekend. I actually only saw the last couple of matches. I was actually kind of shocked, to be honest with you, that Bully Ray lost that match last Sunday against Jeff Hardy. I thought for sure the whole thing with, you know, Hardy being attacked by aces and eights, and again, all of a sudden, Bully Ray comes to his rescue, and he's acting all humbled and almost behaving like a babyface at the pay-per-view, and I thought this was ultimately going to lead to a Bully Ray victory, and whether it was at No Surrender or at Bound for Glory, the big reveal would be that Bully Ray is either leading Aces and Eights or has something to do with Aces and Eights, and who knows, I mean, that could still happen, but they certainly set it up for a Bully Ray win, and Jeff Hardy beat him, a man with one arm, beat Bully Ray clean at No Surrender, which I'm sure sent the crowd home happy, and that was a feel-good ending. Kind of surprised me, even more so, surprised me when Bully Ray lost again, clean to Jeff Hardy on Impact this week. They had a rematch. Jeff Hardy may well be the dumbest babyface ever. He agreed to put his Bound for Glory title shot on the line against Bully Ray. Why he would do this, I have absolutely no idea, other than the fact that he's stupid. And you can't argue that, well, he's a babyface, and so it's a matter of pride. You can't have a babyface turn down a challenge. He's not turning down a challenge. He could accept the match with Bully Ray, but just don't put the title shot on the line. But he did, and I thought for sure that meant that he was losing the title shot, and in fact, he beat Bully Ray again. So it is going to be Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries for the championship at Bound for Glory. I believe the date is October 14th or whatever that Sunday is, in Phoenix. That is the match as of right now. And, you know, again, the thing with Bully Ray and the title shot and everything else, I'm actually happy that Jeff Hardy kept the title shot, if for no other reason, because you've been doing this Bound for Glory series now for months. And I give TNA a lot of credit for it. It has made this tournament feel special. They did a better job on it this year, by all accounts, than they did last year when people didn't know what the hell was going on. This time it was pretty easy to follow the leaderboard and, you know, they have matches at house shows trying to make them more important by putting points on the line. You know, I was at a TNA house show in Brooklyn at a baseball stadium in July, and they had, I think, two Bound for Glory series matches, and people picked up points. And so I think that's a really cool thing that they did. But the thing has dragged on for so long that to have some sort of screw job finish or even worse, have somebody win the Bound for Glory series after all this time, and then on the very next episode of Impact, just have him lose it, you know, just have him put the title shot on the line, and then, you know, Bully Ray were to just beat him for it. It's like, well, what was the fucking point of having this Bound for Glory tournament over the last 3 or 4 months? So in that respect, I'm happy they didn't go in that direction. And Jeff Hardy, if he's the one they want to go with, then he should be getting the title match. There should be no screw jobs. There should be no injury angle to take him out of the pay-per-view next month. He's their guy. They've made the commitment. He has to go to Bound for Glory now and fight for the championship. And I think Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries could actually be a hell of a match. Do I think Jeff Hardy should have won the Bound for Glory series? Jeff Hardy is probably the most popular guy in TNA right now. You know, supposedly he sells the most merchandise. Fans are obviously into him. I mean, if you watched Impact last Thursday, not so much this week, but if you watched Impact last Thursday, I mean, the crowd was on fire for Jeff Hardy. And they were into him this week as well. So, you know, people are into him and you know, probably buy tickets to see him maybe more so than anybody else. I don't know that there's more people buying tickets to see Austin Aries than there are to see Jeff Hardy, because Jeff Hardy's been a big name for much longer than Austin Aries has been. So it's hard to argue. Why wouldn't you, you know, put your top, quote, top guy for all intents and purposes in the title match, in the top match at your biggest pay-per-view of the year? I would not have minded seeing Austin Aries and Bully Ray. I think that would have made sense also. You know, you have your world champion against the biggest heel in the company. The original plan that TNA had in mind was to have James Storm win the Bound for Glory series and get his rematch with Bobby Roode for the title at the pay-per-view. But then Austin Aries got so popular, they took the title off Roode a little prematurely, put the belt on him. And it, again, cool to see that TNA didn't just take the title off Austin Aries a month later. You know, maybe he'll lose at Bound for Glory. I don't know. But he's had a nice little title run for himself since he won the championship from Bobby Roode, and that's really cool to see. So that's your Bound for Glory main event. I'm sure it'll be a good match. I think those guys will have a pretty goddamn good match. I really do. As far as the show this week, classy shout-out to Jerry Lawler on Impact this week by Mike Tenay and Taz. I thought that was a really classy move on TNA's part. They didn't have to do that, but they did. Taz was talking about Lawler being one of his good friends and having worked with him before, and I don't think Tenay has ever worked with Lawler on commentary anyway, but again, very classy, I thought, on their part to make mention of Lawler and give him a shout-out like that on the air. Speaking of dumb baby faces, they did an angle on this show with Miss Tessmacher and Tara, where apparently they've been very good friends, best of friends, for quite a while. Tara's been like a mentor to Miss Tessmacher. Now, I wasn't paying as much attention to TNA 6 months or even a year ago, so it's possible that this has been a relationship that I was unaware of. To me, I've just seen the two of them doing stuff together for a couple of weeks, and so it rings a little hollow to me. But okay, let's say that it's been known for a long time that these two have been very good friends. They did an angle on the show where, after losing to Tessmacher at the pay-per-view, Tara comes out, and she congratulates Tessmacher, and she says, "I want to present you with the championship," even though Tessmacher was already wearing the championship. She wants to put the belt on her herself. And to me, anybody who's been a wrestling fan for more than a month knows exactly what's about to happen, but not Miss Tessmacher. She lets Tara put the title on her, and she goes from post to post, corner to corner to celebrate, and of course she gets her ass kicked from behind by Tara, who knocks her down and leaves her laying. So I just thought to myself, boy, and WWE is guilty of the same thing, the way they book the, you know, the good guys, so to speak, the baby faces, the way they book them sometimes to just be complete and total idiots, where they don't see things like this coming, makes it very hard to cheer for them. And actually, when they did this, Tara was getting a lot of cheers from people in the crowd. They were chanting her name. I'm not sure that was the actual outcome they were going for here. It's kind of like when they did the stuff with Aces and Eights and James Storm, and they were trying to convince everybody that James Storm was in cahoots with Aces and Eights. I don't think the idea was that people would actually start to believe it, but they were. And that's when the reactions to James Storm, all of a sudden he was getting a lot of cheers, and now, not so much. Some of the fans were probably thinking to themselves, maybe this guy is in cahoots with Aces and Eights. So they wrote that off really quickly to make it very clear that he, in fact, was not part of Aces and Eights. But you never know how the crowd's going to react when you do things like that. So I thought that was kind of funny. again, Chris Daniels and Kazarian, probably the best tag team in wrestling right now. They were awesome on this show, very entertaining as usual. They each lost singles matches. AJ Styles beat Kazarian, which means that AJ and Kurt Angle will at some point get a tag team title rematch against Kaz and Daniels. And Daniels lost to Chavo Guerrero. So Chavo and Hernandez will also get a tag team title match at some point. My guess is maybe a Bound for Glory, they do a three-way for the championship, so I guess we'll find out. They had more stuff with Aces and Eights on this show. Not any appearances in the ring by any Aces and Eights members, but more back and forth where Hogan had the entire Impact Zone on lockdown, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing to say, that everybody was locked in, they weren't letting anybody out. If I were a part of the audience there, I might raise an eyebrow at something like that. You ain't locking me in there. Aces and Eights would pop up on the big screen and say, well, how do you know you're not locking yourself in with us? This whole thing to me, you know, the Aces and Eights thing, they got to do something here already. I'm just not into it, you know. And this whole idea that, first of all, you know, they're going out of their way to make this angle, to make this storyline feel really, very realistic, right? You know, everyone's in a panic. Hogan calls the cops, you know. I can appreciate how you know, far they're going to try to make people care about this and make it feel very chaotic. Again, very much like the NWO was in its heyday. But it's impossible for me to take any of this seriously, because obviously Aces and Eights, whenever they go to these pre-tapes and they're sitting at a table, they're in the Impact Zone somewhere. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, they were calling out members of Aces and Eights, and they were walking around freely. They were walking around freely, and all of a sudden, you know, Sting would encounter them backstage. That was when Hogan made his comeback, and he hit them all with baseball bats, right? These guys were just walking around casually backstage at the Impact Zone. How big is this building? This is not a very big building that they tape Impact in. Obviously, Aces and Eights are there. So if you're so concerned about Aces and Eights, first of all, they make a very good point. Why are you locking yourselves in with them? They're obviously there. That's number one. Number two, why don't they just find these people, beat the shit out of them, and get rid of them? Or arrest them, or whatever they want, you know, whatever you want to do. I mean, it's like they're completely helpless. Where are they? Where are Aces and Eights? I didn't know the building was so huge and all these different trap doors and shit. They're obviously there. It's just so stupid to me. It is so fucking stupid to me. I mean, every pre-tape segment they show with Aces and Eights, they're in the same room. They're in the same place, right? They're at that table playing cards or poker, whatever the hell they're doing. Drinking beers. They're in the building. And a couple of weeks ago, you didn't really seem to care that they were just walking around. Now you're so concerned about where are they, or, you know, we've got to lock them out. I mean, it's just so dumb. They have to speed this up a little bit here. And just, you know, I don't know if they can do the big reveal right away. You know, they may want to drag this out for a little bit longer. My guess is that at Bound for Glory is when this is all going to culminate, and we're going to find out who's behind Aces and Eights. Joe Park was on this show, by the way. Joseph Park Esquire, which is always a good reason to watch Impact. His investigation of Aces and Eights, by the way, is progressing very nicely. He told Hulk Hogan that next Thursday he would have evidence. Now, what that means, I have no idea. Apparently, he's waiting for the evidence to arrive. So perhaps, you know, if it's a person, I guess we'll find out who that person is. If it's evidence in the form of documents or a photograph, perhaps in an envelope. I'm not sure why he didn't just FedEx overnight, but apparently it's going to take 7 days for the evidence to get there. So I guess the next big twist will come this upcoming Thursday, and that twist can't come soon enough, because this Aces and Eights thing to me is just dying a death, and they got to do something here with that. So they had that on the show, and a very humorous backstage segment, a segment with Hulk Hogan in a room with Dixie Carter, with Brooke Hogan, and with the other agents, D'Lo Brown, Al Snow, Bruce Pritchard, the head of talent relations. And they were all in a panic about Aces and Eights and how it was not safe and what are we going to do? Oh, my God. And they did editing. They had editing during this segment where I guess they raised the idea that maybe somebody in the room was behind Aces and Eights. Ooh. And then they showed close-ups of everyone's faces with this really corny sound effect in the background. This was so dumb. This was so dumb. But they're going somewhere with this. And again, my argument is just, wherever you're going to go, you better make that stop very, very quickly. You know, if you're driving down the road here, you're not quite ready to reach your destination yet, you're a couple weeks away from getting where you need to go, that's fine, but you're going to have to pull off the side of the road a couple of times and make a couple of pit stops, and hopefully we'll get one of those pit stops on TV this week, because this thing, to me, is a bore. It's a boring angle to me, and they gotta spice it up a little bit here. And having somebody rip their hood off to reveal, you know, Luke Gallows or whoever else is under the mask is not going to cut the mustard there. It's not going to do it. They got to have something else in mind. Although I will say there was a quick backstage thing on this show with Kurt Angle and AJ Styles, and AJ Styles went off for his match, and all of a sudden Wes Briscoe, the son of WWE Hall of Famer Jerry Briscoe, who has signed a contract with TNA. We've seen him on TV, I think, a few times. Wes Briscoe comes walking up to Kurt Angle, and apparently Kurt is all bosom buddies with Wes Briscoe, I guess, because maybe he has an amateur wrestling background or something, and was all buddy-buddy with Wes, and would not surprise me if Wes Briscoe also had some role with Aces and Eights, if he's one of the eight guys that's under the hoods, so that's something to look for. Main event was Jeff Hardy and Bully Ray, as I mentioned, a rematch from the No Surrender pay-per-view. Very good match, actually, between the two of them, and Jeff Hardy once again with a Swanton Bomb wins clean, 1-2-3, and they go off the air with Jeff Hardy celebrating. So Jeff Hardy and Austin Aries at Bound for Glory for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship should be a good match. There's also a lot of friction between James Storm and Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode made his return at the pay-per-view, smacked James Storm over the head with a beer bottle, so they're going to have a match at Bound for Glory, which, again, was always the plan, although originally it was going to be for the championship. And now it's kind of better now, because you can have the two of them have a grudge match. It's one extra match for you to have. Instead of having them face off for the title, you can have a separate title match, and you can still do Bobby Roode and James Storm, and that's what they're apparently going to do. Before I get to the shout-outs, I want to mention this. Pro Wrestling Syndicate, independent, that had a pay-per-view event in New Jersey on Friday night. Demolition actually wrestled on the show. They had a match against the Powers of Pain. I'm sorry I missed that. Reason I bring this up is they had a special guest in the house at the PWS event, and that was Dennis Haskins, better known as Mr. Belding from Saved by the Bell. Big-time wrestling fan. He's been in the audience, the front row, at Raw several times. And actually, I think he had at least one cameo on Zack Ryder's YouTube show once. And a while back, when they were still doing the guest hosts on Raw, right here on Sound Off, I talked about how they should have Mr. Belding come out on Raw as a guest host. I mean, it would be a hell of a lot better than most of the other idiots they have on the show when they parade them out there to promote whatever TV show or whatever the hell they're doing. You know, here's a guy that's a true blue wrestling fan, probably doesn't have anything to promote, but he'd be willing to come on and you know, for one night, here's a guy that played the role of a school principal. He played somebody in a position of authority, so it would actually be perfect to have Mr. Belding on Raw as a GM for one night. Well, on this show, on Friday night, they had him there. He ended up being a guest enforcer for the main event, but before that, he actually came out. There was some screaming and shouting going on between some wrestlers, and the Saved by the Bell theme music played, and out came Mr. Belding, apparently to like the biggest reaction that anybody got on the entire show. And he basically, it sounded, based on reading the results of the show, like he was almost playing the role of a GM, even though he wasn't a GM. You know, he appointed himself a guest enforcer for the main event and all that. He did his whole thing where he goes, hey, 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 what is going on here? And that's what I said they should do on Raw. So I'm actually happy that they took the idea instead of WWE. They had enough sense to come up with the idea, rather. I'm sure they didn't get it from this show, but I was hoping they would do it on Raw, and at least some other wrestling promotion had enough sense to do something like that. So I just wanted to mention that. I thought that was kind of funny. If any, I guess it was an pay-per-view, so maybe I can actually see it. But if any footage pops up on YouTube or something, send me a link. I would love to see that. Let's get to some shout-outs and mailbag questions here. If you have any questions or such to email me, do so at thesolomonster@gmail.com. That's thesolomonster@gmail.com. I just want to mention here Cody Southall, one of our listeners. You might want to change your email password. I think you've been hacked. Been getting some spam mail from you, so you might want to just change that. First shout-out here comes from Luis from Illinois, one of our loyal listeners. was wondering if I can get a birthday shout-out for my special day on the 14th as I officially begin my year-long march to the big 3-0. So, happy birthday to Luis. He has two questions. I guess my birthday gift to him will be answering these two questions. Number one, do you think Paul Heyman's color commentary at WrestleMania X7 has contributed to its status as possibly the greatest pay-per-view ever? No, I don't, actually. I think Paul Heyman did a fine job. Paul Heyman was actually a very good announcer. He was a very good antagonist for Jim Ross. You really got the sense that Jim Ross didn't like this guy. He really did. Maybe the reason being that Jim Ross, to some degree, really didn't like Paul Heyman. But I just think that was Paul doing a really good job of being a slimy little snake. And as far as him making the pay-per-view one of the best of all time, playing a role in that, I think WrestleMania X7 with anybody else in the commentary booth, if Jerry Lawler were there and did the announcing with Jim Ross, I don't think it would have made a bit of difference. I don't think it would have made WrestleMania worse. I don't think it would have made WrestleMania better. I think what made that pay-per-view up and down were the quality of the matches and just all of the big-time matches that they had. They had this massive audience, which was the first WrestleMania. Think about that. That was the first WrestleMania was X7 since WrestleMania 8 in 1992 in Indianapolis at the Hoosier Dome. Big dome WrestleMania that had a huge crowd like that. WrestleMania back in 92 had, I think it was a legit crowd of over, I think it was like 62,000 people in the building. And WrestleMania 17, they claimed an attendance of, I think, over 67,000, which probably wasn't too far off from the legitimate number. It was a big crowd in Houston. And you had Austin versus Rock in the main event, one of the biggest main events in WrestleMania history. Both baby faces. You had even Triple H and The Undertaker, who was really, they were relegated to just an undercard match, was a big match, and it turned out to be a very good match. You had TLC 2 with Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys. You had Vince and Shane in a father-son street fight. Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit was every technical wrestling fan's wet dream at that time. Some people were looking forward, like myself, to the train wreck that was the gimmick Battle Royal. If you were a fan of WWF, back in the day when they had all those gimmicks like Doink and Duke the Dumpster Drozzy and the Goon and everybody in between, you really got a kick out of that. What I loved about the gimmick Battle Royal was that you had Mean Gene and Bobby the Brain Heenan on commentary. The last time Bobby Heenan would ever do commentary for a WWE match. So that WrestleMania was monumental in some ways, and the commentary really didn't have anything to do with that, I don't think. Question number two. Given Rock's two most successful films, Scorpion King and Fast Five, do you think he'll ever reach the pop culture status of a Roddy Piper, who has worked steadily as a character actor, but is not as successful overall? For example, he has yet to act, I guess Rock does, is what Luis is saying. Rock has yet to act in a film where he has a single memorable line, a la Piper's much-quoted kick-ass chew bubblegum line from They Live. True, he doesn't have that iconic movie catchphrase like Piper did in They Live, but I mean, you're asking me, will Rock ever reach the pop culture status of a Roddy Piper? I think he's already past Roddy Piper, quite frankly. I guess that depends on your definition of pop culture status. I think, you know, Dwayne Johnson is a much bigger name in film than Roddy Piper ever was. And speaking from a pop culture perspective, I mean, he's been in a lot of different movies. He's played a lot of different roles. He's been in comedies. He's been in action films. I think he already passed Piper a long time ago. I don't really know what you're talking about, quite frankly, when it comes to that. He may not, again, have that iconic quote from any one movie, but I don't think that really matters. I think he exceeded Piper probably after the first one or two films that he ever did, let alone now when he has all these other movies under his belt. Mike from Carlisle, Kentucky writes in, "Hi, Solomonster. My brother Mark's birthday is on the 18th, and I was hoping to get a shout-out on the sound-off. He is a military police army reserve. Just got back from a tour in Iraq last January. I got him listening to the sound-off when he got back. We both love the show. Keep up the good work." Well, thank you, Mike. That's really cool, actually. Glad to hear Mark is doing well and digging the show. I'll keep doing it if you'll keep listening. This one is from Hasid from Birmingham, England. "I would like a birthday shout-out for Monday the 17th when I will be turning 28. Big and longtime fan of the show. I'm pretty sure I've been listening since episode 1. Either way, I have definitely been listening since November, December of 2007. I'm part of the Fantastic Four. Your show is detailed, insightful, and humorous, and long may it continue. Even though we are from different countries, from different backgrounds, ethnicity, and possibly age, I feel I can relate to you, and that's what keeps me looking forward to downloading the podcast on Sundays and Mondays. So you know, I will be going to the Raw and SmackDown tapings in my home city of Birmingham in November. So that comes from Hasib. Have fun. Email me after the shows and let me know what you think. And I think you'll have a good time. And happy birthday, by the way. So that's the shout-outs. Let's get into some questions here, because I got a bunch of questions that were actually pretty good that I'll get to here. This one comes from Everett, who writes in wanting to know my thoughts on the combination of Daniel Bryan and Kane and the idea of calling them Team Friendship. What do I think of that? Well, I don't know. I mean, I was trying to give some thought to other team names, because Team Friendship is a weak name, to say the least. And quite frankly, when they say Team Friendship, the first thought I had, of all things, it made me think of Mortal Kombat. I used to play Mortal Kombat back in the day. I mean, they probably have Mortal Kombat still now, but I'm talking like Mortal Kombat 2 a long time ago. And I'm pretty sure, unless I'm forgetting this or making this up, that they had something called friendships in the game, where if you did a special combination with the controls, it was like a fatality maybe or something, or an Easter egg, but you could do friendships in the game. Instead of ripping the guy's head off, for example, you gave him a bouquet of flowers or something. So when I hear Team Friendship, it makes me think of Mortal Kombat. I may be the only one in the entire world who thought that, but I don't know. I was giving some thought to it. I thought, you know, here's a pretty cool team name for Kane and Daniel Bryan. Why not call them Dragon Machine? I don't know. It's the first thing I came up with. It's a combination of American Dragon for Daniel Bryan, even though they've never used that nickname for him in WWE, but they should. And Kane being the Big Red Machine. I thought it would be kind of cool to hear them called Dragon Machine. So, anyway. All right. That may not be the best name, but you can't tell me that Team Friendship is a better name than Dragon Machine. You'll never convince me of that. Got an email here from somebody who did not include their name. How about that? Include your name if you send emails in to me. He's been a fan of the podcast for a while, though. He really digs the show. His first question is, what do you think of the idea of revealing Hulk Hogan as the leader of Aces and Eights? Personally, I think it would be quite reminiscent of Mr. McMahon's Higher Power reveal. The betrayal of the fans and his daughter by Hogan might be a cool thing. Admittedly, I have not considered where they would go from there. That's kind of a problem. But it could be a formidable stable if they give the members of Aces and Eights strong characters. I disagree. I don't think that's a good idea at all. I think the days of Hulk Hogan as a heel should be over and done. I think he should stay a babyface for the rest of his career. I know he probably has more fun being the bad guy. A lot of people say that when they do interviews. It's always more fun being the bad guy. Well, Hogan got to be the bad guy in WWE when he came back with the NWO, although he was only a bad guy for about a month. But he got to do the bad guy thing with the NWO and WCW for a number of years, and in TNA as well, he was the bad guy with what was the name of the faction? I forgot already. Fortune, whatever it was, he was a bad guy, and then he became good. He helped Sting. Remember that whole thing? To turn Hogan heel again, to me, is just dumb. Well, I mean, what purpose does it serve? The guy, he could barely move. I mean, he's practically immobile at this point. So he's not able to wrestle a match. He's not really able to take any bumps. So what purpose would that serve? I mean, frankly, I think the role they have Hogan in now, they found the perfect role for him. You can argue that he's maybe making too many appearances. I think it would mean more. He would be more special and more effective if he didn't make so many appearances on a single show. They should probably scale back on that a little bit. But him being in the GM role and you know, being in a position of authority like that, I think is the perfect role right now for Hulk Hogan and TNA. I don't need to see another Hulk Hogan heel turn, especially when all he's going to do is stand there. He can't do anything, so there's no payoff there, so what's the point? Plus, I don't like the focus being on Hulk Hogan with this Aces and Eights thing. I mean, the Aces and Eights thing, like I said, it bores me. They got to do something really fast, but whenever the big reveal is for Aces and Eights, maybe it's Bound for Glory or whenever it may be, I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's Jeff Jarrett leading the Aces and Eights. If it is somebody like Bully Ray, maybe Joe Park is in on the whole Aces and Eights thing. Whoever it is, it shouldn't be Hogan, because the focus should not be brought back to Hulk Hogan. The focus is always on Hogan. That's why I say Hogan now is in the perfect role. Let the focus be on somebody else. whoever the leader is or the leaders of Aces and Eights are, Hulk Hogan should not be one of them, because it brings the focus back on Hogan, and Hogan now is leading a faction of younger guys, or maybe they're not all so young. I don't like that idea at all. The focus should not be on Hogan. It should be on somebody else, anybody else. Cody has a question. Fantastic Four member, listener since episode 198. While most of us do not look back fondly at Triple H's reign of terror, do you think it made the World Heavyweight Championship more prestigious since he would do anything to regain or keep a hold of it, or do you think it devalued the belt since he kept such a stranglehold on it? It's an interesting question, because I've said before, I was not a fan of the reign of terror as it has become known from 2002 into 2003, and I guess you could say into 2004 as well. Triple H had a stranglehold on the World Heavyweight title, and you either liked it or you didn't. You're either a Triple H fan and you loved it, or you hate Triple H's guts and you absolutely hated it. Me, I'm kind of in the middle. You know, I like Triple H. I'm not, you know, I was never a huge Triple H fan or anything like that, but even if I wasn't a Triple H fan, you know, you could still have a world title run that's very successful or very good, even if you don't like that person. So I don't let that cloud my judgment. I just thought that was an extremely boring period on the Raw brand. And that was when SmackDown, ironically enough, they had a lot of great talent on SmackDown. I guess they had the SmackDown 6, although I think that came a little bit later on. That was probably 03. Well, yeah, it was about 03, 04 when they had all those guys on SmackDown. The Guerreros and Angle and Lesnar and I think Haas and Benjamin and whoever comprised the so-called SmackDown 6. Maybe Edge was part of that. But it got to a point where you just got tired of seeing Triple H as the champion. So yes, when you hold on to the title for a long period of time, like CM Punk has done with the WWE title, in theory, it makes the title more valuable. It makes it mean more, and it will mean more when ultimately that person is defeated for the championship. My whole problem with Triple H is, and you take stories with a grain of salt that you hear about things that happen behind the scenes, but I think it's pretty well documented that he had a stranglehold on the title because he had a lot of influence behind the scenes. And there were various points when the plan had been for somebody else to be given a shot, to be given a chance to be the world champion. Maybe the biggest example of that was RVD. Rob Van Dam and Triple H had a match, September of 2002, Unforgiven. The plan was that RVD would get the championship. Now, I'm not going to say whether or not that would have ended up being a good move or not. To me, the timing was all wrong because Triple H had just become the champion a couple of weeks earlier. He was literally handed the title by Eric Bischoff on Raw out of a briefcase that same month. So to take the title off Triple H so soon, I could see where you can argue it was too soon. And other people would say that RVD never deserved to be the world champion. I think RVD deserved a shot, and he never got that shot. Plans changed, he was squashed, and he was never really the same after that. I think it was shortly after that he was moved into a tag team with Kane, somebody else, who also got killed by Triple H. But, you know, it's not even about Kane. I mean, there were other guys that Triple H defended the title against him. It was one after the other after the other. He defended it against Shawn Michaels again, and he defended it against his buddy Kevin Nash, and he defended it against, I mean, anybody and everybody got knocked down by Triple H. And it was just boring. It was just boring after a while. And the one example that makes me angry when I look back on it was in the summer of 03. They had the Elimination Chamber match at SummerSlam. That was when Triple H was hurt. He had like a torn groin. Still wouldn't give up the belt, even though he was hurt. He had to change his ring attire. He was wearing the tightest biker shorts you've ever seen in your life, I guess, to try to mitigate the pain that he was probably feeling from the groin. Because a groin injury is no fun. Believe me, I've slightly pulled my groin before, and that was no fun. I can't imagine what it must be like to tear your groin. So he's wearing these tight biker shorts. He looks completely ridiculous. He's in the Elimination Chamber match. Goldberg is in the Elimination Chamber match. They had brought Goldberg to WWE, and Goldberg was not getting over the way that he had in WCW. He just wasn't. I mean, you go back and watch that feud with The Rock, it's not like people were cheering for Goldberg, and it made sense because a lot of people probably didn't even know who Goldberg was. A lot of those old WCW fans, they left when WCW died and they never came back. People know who The Rock is, so you know that kind of makes sense. But it took a couple of months. Goldberg was finally starting to get over, and I'll never forget that night at SummerSlam. The crowd was into him. I mean, they wanted badly to see Goldberg get his hands on Triple H, and they wanted to see this man just destroy everybody in his path and win the championship. And that was the night to do it. That was the night to put the title on Goldberg, and they didn't do it. They had a screwy, you know, fuck finish. I think Triple H hit him with a sledgehammer. He pinned Goldberg, and then Evolution beat on Goldberg. And, of course, they waited. They waited another month, and they had a Triple H-Goldberg match that was boring. And finally, Goldberg wins the championship. And, you know, it was one of those situations where I think it was too little too late. You know, you got to strike when the iron's hot and all that kind of stuff. And TNA did that, you know, with the whole Bobby Roode, Austin Aries thing. Aries was never supposed to win the title, and he did. And you could say, well, they didn't know. You know, how could they know the crowd was going to be so into Goldberg at SummerSlam? Believe me, if they wanted to make a last-minute change, they could have. That was the time for Goldberg to win the championship, and they didn't do it. And it's just one decision after another like that. And it was just such a dark days for the Raw brand, in my opinion. I mean, people might disagree with that, but that was not a fun time to be watching Monday Night Raw. It really wasn't. It just got to the point where it's like, all right, enough already. Triple H is going to squash everybody in his path. He's going to come out and cut the same boring promo. And it just became too much. Did that devalue the title? I don't think it devalued the title, but I don't necessarily know how much it increased the value of the title. During that period, I saw the WWE Championship, quite frankly, as being more prestigious. You know, when Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle were having great wrestling matches on SmackDown for the WWE title, to me that meant more than any Triple H, you know, world title match. Booker T, by the way, is another example of that as well. Booker T was over. Booker T was a fan favorite, and Booker T was booked with Triple H at WrestleMania 19. He was going to get a world title shot. The Rock put Booker T over great in that Battle Royal. Remember that one Battle Royal on Raw to determine who was going to challenge Triple H for the title at WrestleMania? And it came down to The Rock when he was doing his Hollywood Rock character, and it was him and Booker T, and Booker T just threw Rock out of the ring. Surprised a lot of people, and Rock is sitting there shocked in the aisleway, and all of a sudden he starts clapping and giving Booker T his props, and he's giving him applause. And Jim Ross is going nuts on commentary talking about how Booker T could win the world championship. It's such a big deal. And I was at a Raw taping in March of 2003 when Triple H and Booker T had a face-to-face promo. And Triple H started making comments that were borderline racist. I thought it was dumb. I thought it was stupid. But I also thought to myself, you know, there's no way that they're going to have Triple H out there making comments like this about Booker T if Booker T's not going to win. Probably a pretty good chance that Booker T is going to win the title at WrestleMania. Well, that did not happen. In fact, that's a whole other thing that pissed me off, because if you think back to that match at WrestleMania 19, you will recall that Triple H nailed a pedigree on Booker T. And I know I've talked about this before. He knocked out Booker T with one pedigree at a time when, you know, sometimes in main events it would take Triple H two or three pedigrees to beat somebody. He nailed one pedigree on Booker T. Both guys were down. Now, as a wrestling fan, you're conditioned to watch a wrestling match, and if somebody nails a big move but can't capitalize on that big move right away, right, and they're both down for any length of time, it's probably going to be the deal where they crawl over slowly, and maybe the referee counts slowly, maybe he got bumped or whatever, now the referee's coming back over. Probably going to be a near fall, right? One of those dramatic near falls. Nope. Triple H took about 5 years to crawl over to Booker T, and when he did, he pinned him 1-2-3, and that was it. And I don't think Booker T ever got a rematch either. And it's just, it's things like that that just make you go, what? Why? Why do that? So, yeah, I was not a fan of the Reign of Terror. Some people were. I think more people were not. Everybody has their own reasons. Some people just absolutely hate Triple H. They're just, it's kind of like with John Cena. They're blinded by hatred, which I think is dumb. I don't understand that. It just wasn't a fun time, I think, to follow along on Monday Night Raw. And I was very happy when he finally lost the title to Benoit, and then Benoit lost it to Orton. And, of course, Orton ended up losing it back to Triple H. But it was nice to have the championship on some other people. And I think Orton, you know, it could have done a lot of good for Randy Orton as well. Taking the title of Randy Orton 4 weeks after he won it was also, I thought, kind of a dumb decision. And Randy Orton ended up getting the shaft because they never did build to that big Randy Orton Triple H WrestleMania rematch. They just had Triple H beat him a few more times. I think he beat him at the Rumble. And then Batista. Batista got over, and Batista got the title at WrestleMania the next year. So there you go. Kenneth writes in, He has been a big fan of the show for quite some time. He wants to know about Mark Calloway. Undertaker, as you know, is now 47 years old. He still has what it takes. Do you think that they will keep continuing to use Mark? He says, I understand all of the business, but from watching Raw from literally 1995 and me being 19, I understand his presence and everything. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were and when you think that Vince will induct him into the Hall of Fame. Now, do you also believe if Mark gets inducted that Glenn, that being Kane, has to as well? I would love your opinion, so please elaborate. Well, first thing I would say, don't use their real names. Wrestlers hate it when you use their real names, so a lot of them think it's disrespectful. I happen to agree. If you're going to send an email in with questions about guys, use their ring names, use their stage names. It sounds weird when you say Mark and Glenn, because you don't know them personally. I don't know them personally. I don't call them Mark and Glenn. I call them Kane and Taker, so you should probably do the same thing as well. That's number one. Number two, can Undertaker still go? If that's your question, will WWE keep using him? They'll keep using him as long as he wants to continue wrestling. I mean, he's obviously physically broken down from all the years of abuse. There's a reason he only wrestles once a year. Once a year, I think he can probably get a couple more matches if he wants to. Maybe he has an idea in his head. Maybe WrestleMania 30, he wants to go out with a bang and have one last match. I don't know what's in his head. But if he's only doing one match a year, I figure he can probably go until he's 50 years old if he wants to. And as far as him going into the Hall of Fame, of course he's going to go into the Hall of Fame. He'll go in when he's retired, though. I don't see them inducting Undertaker while he's still actively competing. Unless Undertaker is just one of these guys who's never going to actually retire. He'll just kind of have a match every now and then. But I would think they want to wait until his career is pretty much done and then do a big introduction of him into the Hall of Fame, because that's going to be a big deal when Undertaker goes in. I mean, they should make a big deal about Undertaker going into the Hall of Fame like they did for Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels, because he's been that kind of performer for WWE, very loyal to Vince McMahon ever since he came in. He's always been with the company. He has literally ravaged his body. He has put his body through the ringer for this company. He's had great matches. He had more great matches in the latter part of his career than he did in the early part of his career, although I think a lot of that had to do with his gimmick. Back in the day, he just wouldn't sell anything. He would choke. I mean, go watch some of those early Undertaker matches from the early 90s and the mid-90s. I mean, more so like 91, 92. All he would ever do is choke people. That's it. That was his big move. He would choke. And you compare that, the early days of The Undertaker, to some of the matches he had in the mid-2000s. The match that he had at No Way Out in 06 with Kurt Angle, the matches at WrestleMania with Shawn Michaels, the matches that he had with a bunch of different people, not just Angle and Michaels, but matches that he had with Triple H, matches that he had with Steve Austin, even the early matches with Shawn Michaels in the late 90s, matches with Mick Foley. Talk about the wars those two guys had. So, he'll go into the Hall of Fame, I think, when he's done. And as far as Kane going into the Hall of Fame, absolutely. I've said before, I've talked about Kane and Undertaker before, and how Kane has in some ways shown even greater longevity than The Undertaker has, because Kane physically is not nearly in as bad a shape as Undertaker is in. And Kane, Kane is, I think, himself probably 43, 44 at this point. And you look at Kane, and barring any major injuries, I feel like Kane could go another 10 years if he wants to. Maybe not full time. Maybe he only goes another 2 or 3 years full time and then he wrestles part time. But Kane is in tremendous shape for a big guy of his age. I say a big guy because normally one of the things that affects big men like that are their knees. Kane's still flying off the top rope, doing moves off the top. It's an amazing thing to see. And Kane also, he's been with the company off and on since 1995, when he came in with the Isaac Yankem character. Actually, he's pretty much been with the company since 95. He did Isaac Yankem at first when that ran its course. I don't know if he ever left the company and then came back, but I know they used him for the fake Diesel character in 96. And then they created the Kane character and had him fill the role, and he's been Kane ever since. Since 1997, Kane has been wreaking havoc on WWE. He's suffered a few injuries along the way. Nothing terribly major. I mean, I think he tore his bicep once. That kept him out for a while, but that may be the most serious injury I remember him having. So Kane will absolutely go into the Hall of Fame, and if you judge it on his accomplishments as a performer, you know, he's held every major championship there is to hold, I guess, except the, well, no, actually he did. He held the World Heavyweight title, held the WWE title, Intercontinental title, Tag Team title, I think Hardcore title. So if you're big on championships, although in the end that really doesn't mean much, but you know, if you're big on that, then Kane's done it all. Kane probably has had more championships than Undertaker has during his WWE career. And he's been a very valuable performer. He's worked with a lot of younger guys. He's doing it now with Daniel Bryan, and I'm very entertained by what they're doing with Kane and Daniel Bryan. Kind of reminds me of the old Kane and X-Pac tag team. Kane has had a lot of tag team partners, actually, over the years. He's teamed with, he's teamed with Bryan now, X-Pac, Undertaker, Big Show, right? Mankind, Hurricane. Did he team with Al Snow? For some reason, I think that he may have teamed with Al Snow as well. But, yeah, Kane is, he's had a lot of partners over the years. And he's had women, too. Kane is quite the stud. We all know about Katie Vick, although we probably would like to forget about that. Tori, remember Tori? Lita. Although that was more like an arranged marriage than anything else. I never got the impression Lita was terribly enthusiastic about being with Kane. And then, more recently, Kane's infatuation with AJ. And that big kiss that AJ planted on him that one time on Raw. So, yeah, Kane's had quite a career in WWE, and he'll be in the Hall of Fame one day as well. Last question here comes from Shane from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Who do you think will be more successful on the main roster in WWE, Dean Ambrose or Seth Rollins? And which wrestler do you like better with what you have seen from both superstars? Well, the one who's going to be more successful is the one that WWE pushes the hardest. That's the easy answer to the question. I like them both, but I think Ambrose has more upside in WWE if I had to pick one over the other. So that's going to do it. We're going to close up the mailbag for this week. If you have questions and shout-outs, all that kind of stuff, email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster is the handle. And always some fun stuff going on. And with breaking news and all the Jerry Lawler updates, I was doing my best to post updates and links to various interviews and such. So follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. Friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/thesolomonster. You need to send me a friend request, I believe, to post. We had a lot of activity going on the site this week, including the Raw thread, which exploded, I think, to almost 800 comments this week with everything that was going on. A lot of debate back and forth, people keeping one another updated. So friend me on there. Be part of our little community on Facebook. You can subscribe to this show in iTunes for free. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll see the logo. It'll come right up. You subscribe anytime a new episode goes up, no matter what day of the week it may be, regular show, bonus show, you will be among the first to receive the show. It will automatically download for you, and you won't have to worry about anything. So subscribe in iTunes to the show. And don't forget that on Facebook also we have an official Solomonster Sounds Off Facebook group. For those of you who want to be part of that, a lot of discussion going on in there amongst the various members. I think there's over 240 people who are part of our official group. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off on Facebook, you'll probably see a link to the group. Maybe somebody will post a link to it on the profile page. You have to request membership. I will approve you, and you will be part of it. So do look that up on Facebook. It's a good place. A lot of good people there. And do the iTunes thing as well. I want to thank Bill Mitchell, by the way, one of our listeners, for posting a very honest, very kind review of the show in iTunes. It always helps the show when you actually rate the show in iTunes and post a review, however long or brief it may be. So if you have a few moments to do that, I would really appreciate it. I want to give him a thank you for doing that. So that's episode 237 here for Night of Champions Sunday. Again, I'll be back later on today with Noah Mark. We will be live on SEScoops.com beginning at 7 o'clock Eastern, 1 hour before the Night of Champions pay-per-view goes on the air, half an hour before the pre-show begins. And I will have my Night of Champions predictions. We'll talk about the pay-per-view, probably talk more about Jerry Lawler. We'll take some phone calls. It'll be a good time. So until then, be well, stay safe. For those of you who are celebrating the Jewish New Year this week, Happy New Year. We'll be back next weekend with a brand new episode, as always, number 238, and of course the live show tonight. So until then, take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, Fox. This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.